right, well, let's take our Bibles and let's turn to our passage this evening, which will be in the Gospel of Luke, chapter 12, verses 13 through 21. So again, Luke 12, 13 through 21. And this is the parable of the rich fool. I mentioned last week that our next sermon series will be on the Psalms of Ascents. And those Psalms consist of Psalm 120 through Psalm 134. But tonight we'll be looking at, for lack of a better word, standalone Bible study, which is the parable of the rich fool. So we'll be looking at that this evening. If you want to read ahead, we'll look at Psalm 120 to start the new series next week. But before we look at the parable and all that we have with that, Billy Graham once wrote, "There's nothing wrong with men possessing riches. The wrong comes when riches possess men." So that's a good way to state that. As many of you know, I like to say Jesus, of course, is the master teacher, which we would expect, God in the flesh. But Jesus, one of the modes he taught in was by parable. And parables are stories or illustrations that are used to teach a particular lesson or lessons, if you will. And tonight we're going to look at a parable of Jesus, the parable of the rich fool, which is what the official title is for it. And Jesus is going to warn against greed. We could say also worldliness and materialism, but in particular greed, but how our attitude relates to it in light of eternity. So there's two aspects of the parable. The main one is to focus on greed and the negative effects of greed. But Jesus does this in light of eternity. So there is two sides to it. There's the aspect of greed in the present, but by dealing with the eternal piece of it, we'll also see sort of the full teaching of what Jesus is addressing here. Now, if you like to take notes, kind of, or to just follow along to kind of see where we're going, the first thing we'll do is look at verses 13 through 15, which give us the setting. And the setting is, we would say, a familiar one. It's a dispute. So 13 through 15 gives us the setting of the parable, and it's a family dispute. And the family dispute we'll see is over an inheritance. Not much has changed in years. And then we'll look at the parable itself, the parable of the rich fool, verses 16 through 20. And then we'll look at the lesson, the point, the application of it, which is true riches, verse 21. So again, the setting, verses 13 through 15, is a family dispute over an inheritance, which prompts Jesus to tell the parable itself, verses 16 through 20. And then we'll see the application or the point of the parable. No ambiguity, verse 21, true riches, verse 21. Let's read, though, the setting, which is verses 13 through 15, and kind of get the bearings of before we look at the parable. So Luke 12, verses 13 through 15, someone in the crowd said to Jesus, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the family inheritance with me." But Jesus said to him, "Man, who appointed me a judge or arbiter over you?" Then he said to them, "Beware and be on your guard against every form of greed, for not even when one has an abundance does his life consist of his possessions." So while the parable doesn't actually start till verse 16, what precedes it is important, because what precedes it is what prompts the parable. I like to think of the parables and, of course, the stories as illustrations, but if we rip them out of context or don't look at the cultural aspects of them, a lot of times we can either misinterpret or miss something. In this case, we could do both. So we're going to look at the setting for just a few minutes. Now, if you looked at what precedes in verses 1 through 12 of the chapter, Jesus is speaking and teaching to a very large crowd, and he's teaching on what I would say is a variety of topics. And then out of the large crowd, a man appears, and he asks Jesus to handle a dispute over an inheritance. And William MacDonald makes an interesting statement. He says, quote, "Where there's a will, there's a lot of relatives," and that is so true. That's been true since the dawn of creation, through the Gospels, even till today. But it helps us to get the context, but also the cultural aspect of this. And you'll see when I read this that there's this man that appears out of the crowd, the large crowd that Jesus has been teaching on topics with. And the man wants Jesus to help him with his brother in their inheritance, and he wants him to divide it. Now, at that time, the implication is that there's two brothers that are in view here. And at that time, the law and the way that it was to be rendered, according to Deuteronomy 21, verse 17, is that the older brother would receive a double portion. So if you ever heard that before, this is where that comes from. Deuteronomy 21:17. So in this case, the presumption here is, of course, there's two brothers. So we could think of a pie, and the pie has three pieces. The older brother would get two, and the younger one-third. And so again, inference here a little bit, but we assume that the brother is the younger brother, and he's asking Jesus to divide it up. So in other words, he wants more than one-third. And again, we go with the assumption that that's the case here. Now, Jesus, though, is of course being asked, but we would also take from this that Jesus has been asked to sort of side or join with him against his brother. And Jesus' response is interesting because he refuses to do that. And he, in a sense, says the courts can handle this. If you notice, he says, "Who appointed me a judge and arbiter over you?" And so I like to think of this as Jesus is saying, look, this is a family dispute. This isn't a religious matter, on the surface at least. And says, look, if you want to, go to the courts, go to the judge or an arbiter, and let him deal with this. And Jesus sort of, in a sense, deflects it, but in a way, he does address it. The way he addresses it is he's going to tell a parable that deals with the heart of the issue. Now, for me, I like to think of this parable this way. Jesus is not wanting to litigate the problem here of the inheritance between the two brothers, but by dealing with the heart of the issue through the parable, the hopes is that the younger brother, which we assume that's the one asking the question, will go back and reevaluate whether he even wants to or needs to do this to begin with. And so it's an interesting way of dealing with it. And of course, the negative would be he doesn't listen to Jesus and he goes to the courts and so forth. But in verse 15, Jesus already, if you will, shows what the real issue is. Notice, beware, be on your guard. This we should see here as a warning, and it's to take heed, to be on constant guard. The reason for this would be, of course, two reasons, one of which is the obvious one here in this case, which the man here is greedy. We're looking at an issue of covetousness. But here we see where there needs to be a need, on the other hand, to take constant guard or heed on this, because we could at any time fall prey to this. So said another way, you may not be concerned or have problems with possessions or things now and inheritance now. You may not have a problem with greed now, but it can creep upon you and become a problem if you're not watchful. So this is an issue at heart of greed. Perhaps you could say materialism and worldliness. I'm going to give you two New Testament passages. We won't read them, but I think that they'll be helpful because, again, Jesus knows that there is the propensity for people and an inclination to be greedy, to get caught up in the possessions and things of this world. And it's an ongoing problem. So the two passages you can look at another time would be Ephesians chapter 5 and verse 3, Ephesians 5:3, and then Colossians chapter 2:3, excuse me. So Colossians chapter 3, verses 2, 5, and 6, all dealing with this same general topic of greed. And so Jesus says, surely life is more than the abundance or consist of things with possessions or stuff or things. And so he is, in a sense, saying, surely life is more important than stuff, right? I ran across this story, and it's a while back, and I won't use the NFL player's name, but he's very well known, has won many Super Bowls, and one time said, surely life must be more than winning Super Bowls. There was a sense of emptiness or a void or seeking something beyond just winning Super Bowls. I mention that because this is a problem that plagues people, always has and always will. But the thing to remember with this as well is that Jesus is not saying, and at the beginning of the parable you'll see this, he's not saying that things and possessions necessarily are inherently evil. You think of Job. Job had many possessions. He lost them, but ended up with more at the end. But all the while, we see that Job loved the Lord, not because of possessions, but because who the Lord was and is. And so possessions aren't necessarily bad. The Lord gives us things, but we're supposed to steward them well. They're not to possess us, which is, in a sense, what the Billy Graham quote is. So this launches Jesus into a parable called the Parable of the Rich Fool, verses 16 through 20. And so while he doesn't take the role of a judge or a jury, he does deal with the heart of the issue. So let's read verses 16 through 20, which is the parable itself. And he told them a parable, saying, the land of a rich man was very productive. And he began reasoning to himself, saying, what shall I do, since I have no place to store my crops? Then he said, this is what I will do. I will tear down my barns and build larger ones, and there I will store all my grain and all my goods. And I will say to my soul, soul, you have many goods laid up for many years to come. Take ease, eat, drink, and be merry. But God said to him, you fool, this very night your soul is required of you, and now who will own what you have prepared? So Jesus' response is to respond in a way that is through a parable. And the parable begins by talking about a great and plentiful harvest that the man has. Now, I alluded to this a few minutes ago, but remember, nothing immoral occurs. It is just essentially that a good harvest year has occurred, and nothing negative is said about it, and it shouldn't be, necessarily. The Lord provides for us, and the Lord brings about the harvest. The harvest may be good, it may be not so good, but nothing immoral, and there's no problem with harvest being good. It's everything that follows. Now, the brilliance and the structure of the parable is just that. It's brilliant. And you can see only God could craft a story like this. The way the parable is structured, though, is in verses 17 through 19, what I call the plans of man. And then in verse 20, something's going to change. But for now, let's look at verses 17 through 19, the plans of man. So more stuff, possessions, and money present the man with the problem. What in the world do I do with this great harvest? These are the plans of man. Notice the first person pronouns. Himself, I, and mine. Look at it again. He begins reasoning to himself. What shall I do, since I have no place to store my crops? Jesus is brilliantly weaving this tapestry, this story, that is a very self-centered, narcissistic, man-focused, everything is himself, me, myself, and I, we would say. So notice he said that what will I do? I will tear down my barns. I'm going to have more grain. It's my goods. But curiously enough, in verse 19, The man continues and he says, I will say to my soul. The word there, soul, make note of it if you like to underline things, because we'll return to this later. But what you see in verses 17 through 19 are the plans of man. The man sees all that he has as his. Verse 18, he's not considering sharing with others. You see, he says, I'm going to take and tear down my barns and build bigger ones so he can store all of his abundance of grains and goods. The inference here is, instead of saying, well, I have this surplus, I will give it to A, B, C, D, he sees everything as his. Not only is it come from him, but it's all his. It's interesting, verse 19, where I made the reference to soul, where he speaks about now he can live a life of ease. It's the man's plans for retirement, we would say. So once he has built all this, he's going to retire and live a life of ease. Now throughout this, he's very centered on himself, and all of the focus is on him. But there's no thought of eternity. It's only the present life. So rather than seeing these things as from the Lord, these all come about by his own brilliance and ingenuity. These are all his. But like man, if you think of it today, we often see the future things as in our hands. But we're really looking at just simply focusing on temporal things, not on eternal things. If you go through this, you see he has nothing but the here and now, the present day in mind. And he's completely left God out. Now that is, of course, very indicative and poetic and picturesque of today, isn't it? People plan for retirement, which is nothing of itself wrong, but they plan for the future, but they leave God out. They leave God out of the present and the future, and they have no place for him. They see everything as having come from them rather than ultimately coming from God and returning thanks for that. Everything is about them, and their only focus is on the life here and now. As a pastor, I have done many funerals, and there's never a U-Haul truck or van, I like to say, at these funerals at the graveside, because man can't take him those things with him. And for a worldly person who's only focused on the here and now, in many ways, I suppose that would be the case, because that's all they know is now. And when the life is over, it ends here. It ends in this life. Now, I mentioned that there's a brilliance to the structure of this parable, because the man's talked a lot, just like I guess I have and am right now. But in verse 20, everything changes, and you can see the brilliance of Jesus' structure. The man's talking, but no longer does the man talk. God does. Notice verse 20. But God said to the man, you fool, this very night your soul is required of you, and now who will own what you have prepared? So the man's been speaking a lot, but now God comes and says to him, your life is over. All that he has thought was his will be given to another. And all of these things, they're lost in a sense for eternity. All the grains and all the goods and all the barns and so forth. He's lost all of them because they've ended at the grave, you'd say. Two things in particular I mentioned before was the word soul. He spoke to his soul, but when God comes, God is the one who has divine authority over his soul. Notice the divine call from God is for his soul, not for his stuff. God is the one who owns ultimately the soul. He has possession of it, if you will. In other words, he is the one who is going to come reckon that on the day of judgment. And he calls the man a fool. Of course, the obvious is that he's foolish, is what the implication is here. In the Greek, it gives the idea of one without reason. And the man is seen as a fool or foolish because he's made plans for everything but his own soul and for eternity. Now that is obviously a picture, again, so much of today. People plan for everything but for eternity. They prepare for nothing beyond this life. They not only leave God out of the present, but also out of eternity. William MacDonald writes, "Someone has defined a fool as one whose plans end at the grave." And that is so true, isn't it? The man here in the parable, and let's make sure we're clear, Jesus is not speaking of the man who brought the question. So remember the setting. There's a family dispute between a younger and older brother. And the younger brother, again, this is by a presumption here, implication, the younger man comes and wants Jesus to divide up equally, is the inference, with his older brother, because we would, according to the law, think that he's getting a third rather than a half, and he wants more, as though a third isn't enough. And so he goes and asks Jesus to do this, but Jesus says, look, if you want to really address the issue, listen to this parable. And so the parable has a man in it, and the man has everything this world offers, but he has nothing that eternity offers. He has nothing beyond what is in the here and now. And so the parable brilliantly, beautifully, perfectly pictures a picture of a self-centered, self-focused life, building a life for the here and now only, and being completely unprepared for eternity. And in fact, not even giving any thought to it. And isn't that, again, so much like today? So many people are prepared and spend so much time on things of this world. Even Christians, we can get caught up in the things of this world, our possessions. And again, it's not money and riches that are the problem. Possessions, those things all come from God. But it's when those things possess us, as we saw earlier. But Jesus's point, there is no ambiguity. You know, in the parables, sometimes you can look at them and mull over them, but there's no ambiguity to the point, to the application. And so we've seen the family dispute, the quarrel or predicament that the gentleman is in. We've seen the parable teaching here. But what is Jesus's point? And it's verse 21, and it's true riches, as I like to call it. So let's read verse 21 and look and see at the application, because again, there's no ambiguity. So Luke chapter 12, verse 21 is the application or the point of the parable. So is the man who stores up treasure for himself and is not rich towards God. So Jesus concludes the parable by stating that this is the fate of all people who are only rich in the things of this world, but are totally, utterly bankrupt towards God. They're bankrupt towards that which is of eternal value and what is of utmost importance. So the question is, of course, what is the reference there? So, of course, I love the phrasing there, storing up treasures. Isn't that what the man in the parable has been doing? That is what the parable pictures. But in a sense, by implication, so is the young brother who is looking to store up treasures. He's mainly focused on the treasures of this life. But notice the second part of the application. He's not rich towards God. Going backwards, the man in the parable, he's not only not rich towards God, he's bankrupt towards God. He has no thought of God. Just like, again, the implication, the inferences of the younger brother who brings the question. I like to think Jesus is not looking to be judge and arbiter. He's not looking for a court or a law to fix the problem because it can't. Let me explain what I mean by that. Today, we assume that, well, if we could just pass a law, get a new senator or a new judge or a new president or a governor, whatever the case may be, pass certain laws, that it would fix man's greatest problem. And that is such fallacy. Man has been given government, and government has been given to man to exercise authority and to restrain evil, but it can't completely remove it. The issue here is not with a court or a law or even a judge. even if he ruled in the younger brother's behalf and gave him half, he still wouldn't have the real problem dealt with, which is that it's a heart problem. And the heart problem is that the man is not rich towards God. He's not rich towards that which is of utmost eternal value. So what does it mean when you're a Christian? Are we rich? And the answer would be yes. Now, before you think I'm speaking of word of faith or name it and claim it, no, we are rich, but we are rich in the things that really matter, those things that will last beyond this life. Let me give you an example. Let's turn to Ephesians chapter 1. Ephesians chapter 1 is one of many examples, in many ways countless examples, of the blessings we have in Christ. I would encourage you to read the entire chapter 1 of Ephesians. But let's just, for our purposes, read Ephesians 1, 3 through 6. So that's Ephesians 1, 3 through 6. Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, who has blessed us with every spiritual blessing in the heavenly places in Christ, just as he chose us in him before the foundation of the world, that we would be holy and blameless before him. In love, he predestined us to adoption as sons through Jesus Christ to himself, according to the kind intention of his will, to the praise of the glory of his grace, which he freely bestowed on us in the beloved. Believers have true riches in Jesus Christ, or through Jesus Christ. And through Jesus Christ, we have so many blessings. We have sin removed from us, the guilt of sin. We have things that we don't even fully comprehend in eternity. No eye has seen, ear heard, all that God has for us. And so Christians are truly rich. We may not have material wealth. The Lord may bless us with those things, but we don't have to have those things. But whether we have them or not, they're not going to last, and they're not going to be with us beyond the grave. Let's look, if you did turn back to our passage in the Gospel of Luke chapter 12 before we finish, and let's read 12, meaning chapter 12, verse 31 through 34. And you can really see the driving home point here. So that's Luke 12, verses 31 through 34, before we finish. But seek his kingdom, and all these things will be added to you. Do not be afraid, little flock, for your Father has chosen gladly to give you the kingdom. Sell your possessions, give to charity, make yourselves money belts which do not wear out, an unfailing treasure in heaven, where no thief comes near nor moth destroys. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. So the lesson of the parable is to be rich towards the things of the Lord and our relationship with him, to invest in that which is eternal rather than temporal. And you can really see this in verse 34, can't you? It really sums up the parable very well. Where is the treasure of the man in the parable's heart? It was in his grains. It was in his storehouse. It was in his goods. The implication or inference is the young brother who asked the question, that his treasure was here on this earth. It was in the same things. It was in materials. It was in good. It was in greed. You would think that having one third of an inheritance would be sufficient, or that you would just be grateful for what you received, but the one third wasn't enough and he wanted more. And so his treasure was on the things of this earth, because that's where his heart was. What Jesus is saying is that our heart should be focused on the things of God. It should be those things in heaven. If you notice the reference here, 31 through 34, is very similar or a variant of what we think of in the Gospel of Matthew in the Sermon on the Mount. You could read about this in the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew chapter 6, for example. But here it really drives home the point to be rich towards God, the things of God, to have our heart focused on the things above, not on this earth. And even Christians can get caught up in that, where we are focused on the temporal things rather than the eternal things. And we need to balance those out, obviously. We need to take care of those things that God has given to us to steward, but the eternal things are more important. And so before we conclude, I'm going to read this poem, and the poem comes from C.H. McIntosh, and I think he sums this up so well. This idea of focusing on the eternal things, the heavenly things, avoid covetousness, greed, and just be thankful for what we have, but also remember that regardless of what we have, we are truly rich. So C.H. McIntosh says, "Away with all this poor world's treasures, all this vain world's tasteless pleasures. My treasure is in heaven, for I have found true riches now. My treasure, Christ, my Lord, art thou." C.H. McIntosh. And so the treasure is Christ and everything that flows from him. And of course, to him be the glory forever and ever. Amen for sure. So again, we'll close in just a minute, but next week we'll begin the Psalms of Ascent, Psalm 120, so you could read ahead for that. Until then, God bless.